You're listening to the Clutter Fairy Weekly, a weekly webcast and podcast brought to you by the Clutter Fairy in Houston, Texas. If you'd like to participate in one of our live webcasts, please visit cfhou.com/weekly. You'll find a calendar of upcoming webcasts, as well as instructions for joining the Zoom meeting via the app or by phone. We'd love to see you. That URL again is cfhou.com/weekly. Now here's the weekly episode. Enjoy.
Hi, Clutter Fairy fans. This is the Clutter Fairy Weekly for April 12th, 2022. I'm your co-host, Ed Gumnick, and I'm speaking with Gail Goddard, certified professional organizer and owner of the Clutter Fairy in Houston, Texas.
Hi, everybody. The Clutter Fairy Weekly is the webcast and podcast that digs deep into the clutter that piles up between you and the life you want to be living. We explore the habits and behaviors that lead to clutter, and we suggest strategies to slow the accumulation, reduce the collection, and comfortably manage the stuff we decide to keep.
If you're new to our Zoom meeting, we want to let you know that you can share your comments and questions via the chat, and I'll try to make sure Gail addresses them before we move on to another topic. You can also use the raise hand feature to let us know that you'd like to ask a question or make a comment yourself via audio or video. We're also streaming the webcast live on Facebook, so you can share your questions and comments there, and I'll relay them to Gail. We're going to start today, as we usually do, by discussing last week's tittle, which was called How Ready Are You? The assignment was to begin or update your preparations for a crisis in your life or the life of a loved one. Let's hear from our participants in Zoom and Facebook who worked on either a list of useful information or your grab and go box this week. Please let us know in the comments. We heard from NJD on YouTube who said, thank you for this very necessary info and the lists. Want to pass on an experience I had and encourage others to take action if necessary. My father died unexpectedly when my sister was 11 and I was 9. Shortly after, our mother became ill and passed away a few years later. My mom had chosen her sister to be our legal guardian. Thank God she and her siblings made this decision and we were both lovingly taken care of even after we were married. Make any preparations necessary as life is so uncertain. Thanks for that, NJD.
That's an example of, you know, an extreme situation that you pray never happens, and sometimes it does. Most of the time we talk about end of life stuff, but that's a perfect example of two adults that didn't get to live their full active life they're on the planet. They didn't get to be here and they left kids behind, and thank God they were able to prepare for it.
Yeah.
I did get a lot of comments. We saw a lot of people talking about their own situation, places where it got hung up for them, things, challenges that they had to face. And I can tell that it resonated with people. A lot of people had either had an experience or heard about an experience and had things to say about it. So I know it's a hard topic to listen to. And we got a lot of comments like that. Oh, this is challenging. Oh, this is hard. But it's necessary. And we hadn't done it for a long time. So it's time to circle back for a minute.
Yeah. We also had a comment from Mary who said, I would add that writing down one's driver's license number would be beneficial. I misplaced mine and went online to the DMV site to get a replacement. It asked for my driver's license number, which I didn't have memorized.
Right.
Luckily, after spending most of the day looking for it, the license was stuck in a different slot, facepalm, but so happy to have found it. Thanks for sharing the great info in the podcast.
Oh, you're so welcome. And we can all totally relate. You go online to do something and you're like, yeah, we need the number. I'm like, I wouldn't be online if I had the number. Like, that's right. The whole point. But unfortunately, you know, the companies cannot read our minds. So having that stuff, just a carbon copy of the credit cards and driver's license somewhere, a Xerox copy would be helpful.
M said, I didn't get far on the tittle, but thinking about it changed my attitude.
Oh.
About my stuff. Imagining the landlord tossing family keepsakes into the dumpster got me started.
Oh, there you go. Because they certainly don't know why that's important or who those people are or anything like that. So that is a very good point. sometimes you just have to imagine who's going to clean it up behind you and what they might be doing with it. And maybe that'll be enough to spur you on. Congratulations. Good for you. Yay.
Samudra said, scan all your wallet's contents and keep in a safe place. That's a great idea.
Right.
Lee said, started writing my obit and realized I want to make it lighthearted and comical.
I've seen that. Lots of people do that. It's absolutely, if you don't want to be sad and somber, why not be lighthearted? If you're lighthearted in life, why not be lighthearted in your obit? That's a perfectly reasonable thing to do.
And then someone commented about their grandfather having, here we are. A number of my relatives didn't know that my grandfather had his pilot's license. It may be a relief if your funeral/memorial is already written or outlined. People rarely are thinking clearly in the days after a death.
Well, and the young people that are having to pick up the ball, they know you as a parent or a grandparent. They don't know you as a person. They never bothered to ask you, they just want to know what's for dinner. They're not asking you what you did as a young person. They don't have that filtered in there.
They may not be aware of your four previous marriages or the time you served.
Or the summer that you went to, South America to work and volunteer. Who knows?
Jane said, I'm waiting permission from a family member to put her on as my Facebook legacy contact. Until you mentioned it, I was completely unaware of the option. Kara said, gosh, used this last week as I was able to go to a very nicely contained Go file box to grab a DNR for my sister-in-law's 97-year-old mother, who we needed to get to the hospital.
Oh my goodness.
It makes things so much easier to have the wishes clearly documented and at the ready.
Wow. That's amazing.
And Marshmallow said, hi all, updated all my contact lists to be allowed into my storage, etc.
Oh, that's cool. That's very helpful.
Anya said, I did the test about my husband and scored 17. I forget what the scale was, but I think that's pretty good. That's darn good.
Awesome.
Yeah. Considering how much really esoteric and obscure information was on that list.
Right. That's pretty good, right? Well, yeah, because the list is like 26 items long. So, sorry, y'all. The oak pollen here is like in the tens of thousands. So I'm really struggling.
Marshmallow also said, I also redid my to-go box to include my husband's urn. Oops.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's a good one. You probably want him to go with you. That would be lovely. Yes. You don't want him to be lost.
Em also pointed out, part of the job of an obit is to identify yourself to the people from your distant past. So those early life activities may be important to list.
I actually had this conversation with somebody this week as we were going through some old stuff, and we found an obit about one of her relatives. And I said, do you want this in the genealogy pile? And she said, genealogy? Why would it be in genealogy? I'm like, oh my gosh, they use obits for research because it always has birth and death dates. And it says who the relatives are. And it says who you used to be married to and who you're now married to. And there's all kinds of information that is really useful for somebody that's doing genealogy research. And so I always think of obits as a genealogy tool. And she was quite surprised and then allowed me to put them in the genealogy box, which is going to be shipped to someone else in the family.
Joyce said, the one thing I regret about the services for my father in 2019 was allowing the funeral director to persuade me not to pay for publishing the obits in the newspaper.
Oh, well, I wonder why the funeral director would do that. That's interesting. Well, it's expensive. It's very expensive.
It is. I don't know. I guess it kind of depends on, what is the likelihood that the people who need to see it will see it in your local paper, so there may be instances where if you didn't live there long or something like that, you wouldn't bother with that expense. Most of them operate their own websites for obituaries.
Yeah, I guess they do now.
Mm-hmm. Which are nice because, they're searchable. And if you're trying to find out what has become of an old friend, they will sometimes the name will pop because it's in an online obituary. And Marshmallow replied that I have a huge sign on my go bag to not forget him, the husband in the urn.
Aww.
Safely to quick tuck under my arm going out the door.
Right, to run and go. That's nice.
Yeah.
I'm sure he appreciates it.
Okay, we should get to our main topic. Our main topic, the way we talk about our stuff reveals a lot about the emotions and memories that influence our choices. Words like enough, junk, and value are loaded with history and meaning for each of us, but they also possess power to keep us stuck or to help us move forward. Today, we're going to examine words that we use to describe our cluttered lives and share insights into how to reframe language to better manage our relationship with stuff.
The words we use to talk about our homes, our lives, and ourselves have power. Using negative language, especially negative self-talk, can exacerbate negative feelings. Using positive and affirmative language can improve our attitude and our outlook. Our belief about what those words mean or do or give us can block us from moving forward, or they can support our lives. So today we want to examine words that trip up many who are trying to face their organizing projects. And we're hoping to spark some thoughts about how you use these words and the how they might be stopping you or how they could be helping you. Clearly, the first word we have to start with is clutter, because that's like the end all be all why we're here, right? We've talked about our definition of clutter many times, but let's say it again. Clutter is anything that gets in the way of having, doing, or being what you really want to have, do, or be. That's not a decision that we can or should make for you. And it's also not one that you can make lightly. We want to encourage you to reflect and have honest conversations with yourself and the people that you share your space so that you make informed, heartfelt, and confident decisions about what stuff gets to live with you. Clutter isn't the stuff that your spouse likes. Just because your spouse likes it and you don't, doesn't make it clutter. Clutter isn't anything that's sitting out on a surface. Clutter is the piles that you can't identify, the piles that you keep dumping stuff onto, and the stacks of things that don't help you function, but instead prevent you from functioning in your space. Lots of people tell me they know what's in that pile. Then we take it apart and we find four things that we've been searching for that for ages. We thought we lost it. Well, you did lose it, even though it was still in the house, because it wasn't in a place that was logical to find it again. So those piles become clutter when you don't have any idea what generally is in the pile. And I know there are people that make big piles and they can put their hand in the middle of it and go, I think what I need is right here, and they can pluck it out. And if you're that person, awesome. And then likely the clutter for you is that those piles become, they multiply, they become too, there's too many of them, and they start to, yeah, and they start to block free movement of space and free use of the contents of your space. But generally, a pile is clutter because you don't know what's in it. And therefore, you can't go to that clutter pile and find something when you need it. And that's how it becomes clutter. Let's talk about perfect. Here's another word that we talk about a lot. Let's just drop that word from our vocabulary. It would be so helpful if we could do that. Your home is never going to be anywhere near perfect unless you're staging it for sale, and probably even not then. You live in it, so it's always going to be in a state of flux, and that's okay. Someone just wrote that getting it perfect was a huge weight that we carry around like a shield, as if it's protection, but it's really just the weight that prevents us from flying. And I have to say that I actually saw this last night on social media, and then 10 minutes later, I couldn't find it again. So whoever said it, please claim it. My apologies for, co-opting it here today. But the point is, we think getting it perfect is going to achieve something for us, one, that we need for some reason, and two, that we can't be happy without. Except no one who ever achieves perfect really stays perfect for more than a few minutes. And the happiness that arrives with perfect is fleeting too. It's really a target that's impossible by design. So don't aim for perfect. Instead, aim for functional and pleasing and accomplishable, and it's in my budget. Decide to be happy about it at that point and move on. And let that aim for perfection stop being your unattainable goal. Memory is another one that we need to talk about today. If you're saving an object only because you associate it with a pleasant memory, then is there a way to let the item go but still preserve the memory? Take a photo, write a story about it. We've talked about that before. Sentimental attachment to an object helps you maintain memories of a loved one. But if most of that attachment makes you feel guilty or sad or sorry or angry, then it's not worth the emotional cost to keep it. Keep things that give you a warm feeling. If that's a huge list of things, then keep the things that have a big warm feeling. Look for the items that concentrate the good feelings into one or two objects. Quality is always better than quantity in this instance. And keeping everything usually means you just don't want to go through the exercise to choose among the many things. So the next question, the next word we want to contemplate is enough. What does enough mean? We often ponder the question, how much is enough? And many people who struggle with clutter sometimes use their fear of scarcity as a rationale for keeping an inventory of supplies, food, household goods, toiletries, reading material, arts and crafts, office supplies, equipment. Those supplies that would last way beyond even a long-term need. So what is your personal definition of enough? Your answer will depend on what specific category stuff we're talking about, how you use or consume that item, and how your life experiences have shaped your attitude about stuff. Here's a simple example. If you eat yogurt for breakfast every day and you shop once a week, you're going to need to buy 7 cartons of yogurt every time you shop. But maybe sometimes you don't eat breakfast at home, and maybe sometimes you don't get to the store every week. Yogurt doesn't keep forever, so you have to balance the likelihood that you'll eat the yogurt on any given day against the likely frequency of your shopping, as well as how much room you can spare in the fridge, and so on. But our natural inclination seems to be to err on the side of caution, and so we overestimate our need, we underestimate the ease of resupplying, and we exaggerate the gravity of running out of something. God, that is so true. The next thing you know, you have a 6-month supply of yogurt in the fridge. We always exaggerate the gravity of running out of something and forget that we can cope, that we can pick an alternative. It may not be our perfect or our favorite, but we will still be able to get something that will work in the short term. And if we really run out of scotch tape, is our life over as we know it? No, it's not. And so developing the ability to bob and weave with the bells and whistles, the how things resupply, how often we have or run out of something, just being able to adjust to that change.
Be prepared to embrace a substitute.
Yeah, for a minute. Like,
Have an adventure. Maybe it won't be Folgers this time.
But even the one that you buy as the substitute is going to run out and you're going to have to resupply that. And so there's always a little bit too much panic about not having something that is not really reflective of our ability as humans to adjust and cope and resupply with something else and live with what is available. So just keep in mind, if you run out of your favorite yogurt, your life is not going to be over. Here's the flip side of enough. Do you have enough space for all the stuff you're trying to store? Will you have enough time and opportunity to consume all those supplies before they degrade and become useless? If we try to keep enough of everything that we will ever need, we may find ourselves living in a warehouse, not in a home. And how much is enough when we're talking about things that fall outside the realm of basic human needs? When you have plentiful resources and live in an affluent society, it's easy to forget that you don't have to meet every desire every single time it arises. It's actually okay to allow yourself to run out of Oreos or Cabernet Sauvignon or fabric softener sheets or earrings. It's not going to kill you. And you can sort of live in that space of, I ran out of something for a minute and see what happens. And this is the perfect place to talk about next, need versus want. It's easy to casually ignore the distinction between the things that we need and the things we just want very much. Need is about what supports your life, what allows you to do what you do. You need to eat, but you don't need 12 months of food in the pantry. You need some supplies against whatever emergency situation happens in your area, but you don't need a bunker full of stuff for a year-long standoff. Want is because you think it's cool. Want is something you think is pretty or fun or special. Want is only about your interest in something. The problem comes when you want more than you can actually fit in your space. Sometimes when you're hungry, you want to eat more than can actually fit in your stomach. We overeat and then we're totally stuffed. Keeping everything we want is a similar problem. When we take and keep things based solely on the fact that we want it with no other filter, then we end up buried in things that we wanted, but now can never find to use or play with. Wanting something is never enough of a filter. Want has to intersect with some practicalities, like how much time and space you have for this want. We all have an endless fountain of want, but we have finite space and finite time and resources. It's important to let what you want be bounded by your actual space and the time you have to play, so the volume of wants that you keep is manageable. You're not a toddler hoarding all the toys. Stand in the adult version of you and evaluate the want with more practical boundaries. Space is another word we want to cover today. Space is not for storage. Space is for living. Space can be empty. This is always a shocker to people when I tell them that. We clear out something that's been completely jammed up, and then they have an empty drawer, an empty cabinet, or an empty service. And it's like, oh my gosh, I got to start putting things in there right away. No, you can just leave it empty. It's okay. Filling a physical space won't fill your heart. Our emotional landscape is an internal space that isn't truly affected by a stuffed physical landscape. And if you're filling up your physical space to cope with an emotion like fear or loneliness or grief, it's time to reach out for guidance about managing your feelings in an internal way instead of the external attempt of stuffing your space with contents. Open space allows the freedom to move easily through our homes without risk or discomfort or struggling. That clutter is a barrier to easy movement, and moving things from place to place over again wastes a lot of your energy. And so that space, those empty spaces and things being in a space that's easily accessible, means that it's easy for you to move around and you don't waste a lot of time shuffling things inside the space. What about junk? Junk is a good one, and it's totally subjective. What is junk to you may not be junk to others, and vice versa. We say words like junk really casually, but that might reveal our conflicted feelings about an object. Our suggestion could be, when you find yourself calling something junk or a similarly negative or dismissive word, spend a few moments reflecting on your word choice. Is junk an honest assessment, or are your feelings a mixed bag here? How do you really feel? Maybe you're just overwhelmed or feeling challenged by what to do with something. I think mostly the word junk reflects a level of frustration about the workload and how much time will be spent to solve a problem that one doesn't want to be bothered to solve. And in that position, standing in that level of frustration, suddenly everything is junk. The flip side of that is value. Value is largely subjective also, but that doesn't seem to stop us from trying to use the perceived value of things to justify the space that they take up in our lives. We talk a lot about the sunk cost fallacy, the pattern of thought that says that because we spend a lot of money or energy or effort or time on something, we're obliged to keep it. But that notion is based on a skewed idea of what things are worth based on what they cost, and it can keep us trapped in decisions that we regret. yeah, that pair of shoes cost $300, but it turns out that they're unbearably comfortable to wear, and maybe you've changed your mind about the color. Don't use that $300 price tag as a distraction from your real assessment of their value, which is zero, if you never wear them. We also attribute a lot of value to things that we consider rare or special or collectible. But I think sometimes that we assign value to things as a convenient way to keep from facing our actual feelings about them, which might lead to a difficult decision. Sure, mom's Hummels meant a lot to her, but if you find them too creepy to display in your house, is their value a good excuse to keep a box of them cooking in your attic for a decade? That, and Hummels particularly is one that they had a moment in time. Everybody bought them and spent money on them. They were considered the, you know, collectible decoration that everybody wanted. And then that moment passed and the rest of us are like, really? What are we going to do with all these ceramic birds, mom? Come on. Useful. This is a good place to remind you about the William Morris quotation, which was, have nothing in your houses that you do not know to be beautiful or believe to be useful. Usefulness can be a good standard, but we have to be careful not to confuse real usefulness, which is clear, straightforward, and quantifiable. I used this yesterday, I'll use it again tomorrow, with potential usefulness, which might just be a hiding place for a deferred decision. I'll use this when I have time to start painting again. We're not saying that you shouldn't hold on to anything unless you use it all the time, but we're suggesting that you examine any decision to keep something for its potential usefulness with as much skepticism and objectivity as you can muster. Ask yourself a few probing questions like, what's the time frame for this thing to be useful? How enthusiastic am I about taking up this activity again? Do I even enjoy rollerblading? I would say not anymore. Make sure an item's usefulness doesn't become an excuse to keep it when it no longer makes sense to give up space to it.
Let's have some comments.
We're ready for comments.
Leela suggested, she says, enough to me equals easy to maintain. That's a great standard.
That's an excellent point. And exactly part of the practical evaluation of something, right? If you can manage what you have, then it's got to be, that has to be enough. It's a good filter.
Ginger said, I write stories and take photos, then post them to Facebook in a private photo album. I feel it's parked somewhere and I could retrieve it when I want.
Which allows you to park your memory somewhere that can stay and you don't have to keep the object, right? That's a good thing. I like it.
On the subject of yogurt, Lise said, the sale too doesn't help. Yoplait 10 for $10.
Yeah, because you know, they know that you'll be grabbed by that and then you will fill your refrigerator with more than you can actually eat. It's a marketing technique that's designed to make you buy more than you know you will consume.
Now, yogurt wasn't a perfect example because yogurt really does have a pretty long shelf life. And I eat yogurt as much as 4 months beyond the expiration date because my attitude is yogurt starts out spoiled. How much worse can it get? You know? And really, I mean, well, when you open one and it has gone beyond normal yogurt spoiled, you tend to know that right away. And
but the thing is that it may have a long shelf life, but you're going to go to the refrigerator. I mean, you're going to go to the grocery store way more times than over that time period, right? Like, you're going to end up stocking the 10 for 10. And even though you can eat it 4 months later, you'll still have 50 yogurts in the fridge waiting to be eaten. So yeah, this is where the sale doesn't help you if you can't actually consume it. It's no fun to buy 10 for 10 and then throw 5 of them away because they've turned into a science experiment.
Yeah. Tammy said, my trauma makes me panic buy and hoard little things.
It is one of the emotional coping skills that we default to when we feel overwhelmed, traumatized, distressed. It is. And learning some alternative coping mechanisms in that moment is really important. And so this is where I would take that sentence that you just wrote and go sit in front of a trusted friend, the therapist, whoever, the religious person that you interact with, that will allow you to talk about the fear, process how you feel, see if there's an alternative that you can do to calm yourself down, to make yourself feel less threatened, to get out of panic and into calm again before you go buying things.
Yeah. Barbara said, this is on a lighter note, I apparently have a deep-seated fear of running out of Post-its, a lifetime supply in my closet.
Post-its just seem so cool and useful, right? This is the office supply dilemma. They're designed to be useful. They all have a very specific function. And the problem is that you can't possibly use all of the office supplies that you have. That's just the drill. So I just keep cutting it in half. If you have a collection, cut it in half, and then later go back and cut it in half again, and then cut it in half again. And you just keep shrinking the population until it's down to, you have three. And what if you actually ran out of Post-it notes? Oh my God, your life would be, you would be so thrilled, because then you could go to the store and buy a new Post-it note.
So, do you remember that give yourself moment?
That possibility.
Do you remember that moment in our working lives when suddenly Post-its were available in a color other than yellow?
Yes.
I wonder how many people still have like a hoard of fluorescent pink and green and all those new colors that were so fabulous, you know?
Right. And then they started having memes on them and little cartoons and all that stuff. Yeah. It's so true.
Ginger said, exploring other options to Folgers, that sounds sacrilegious. I only said Folgers because that's what my parents like. They like the Folgers decaf crystals.
Right. That was their thing.
I myself. Well,
and we
like,
all
you know,
get attached to a favorite, right? But there's always a new one out there.
I like, you know, bougie, freshly roasted, light roasted beans from countries scattered around the world. Jane said, the scarcity of products early in the pandemic helped me to get much more flexible while trying new products. My attitude now is that not having something available is an opportunity to try something new.
There you go. Exactly. And there's always going to be somebody that comes in to fill the void when a product disappears, right? So there will always be some new options. And maybe you won't love it as much. I have a memory in my head of a story that a hairdresser told me once. The people that make hair products rebrand them constantly. They change the colors of the packaging. They change the shape of the logo. They're always trying to refresh it to make it look like a new product when it's really the same product. And the shampoo that she sold went through that transition one time. And one of her clients just lost her mind because it wasn't the same shampoo that she had been getting forever. And the hairdresser explained very carefully, this is exactly the same shampoo in a different colored bottle with a new logo. It's the exact same product. And that was not good enough for her. But it's not the right thing. And so the hairdresser had to go out and like try to find all of the bottles of the old branding and sell them to her, so that she could have like a wait time for the change. And by the time she ran out of the old ones, I'm sure they'd been through 17 more brandings and changes. And they were all that way, that much farther down the road. Being super attached to a product's look is, you know, you're guaranteed to be disappointed sometime in life. Being more flexible is a better way to live, right? I like it.
It's certainly a more resilient way to live.
Yeah.
Samudra said, the original Lord's Prayer specifies, give us this day the food we need for today, or the things we need today.
That's a good extrapolation of that. I like it.
Yeah.
And it's a perfect example of, they're talking about being in the moment and needing what you need now and only trying to worry about what is necessary today and not worrying about making sure you have 6 months of stuff down the road.
Yeah. Ginger said, I've been trying less expensive options in my efforts to cut expenses. We've been doing a lot of that too. And we, you know, we got HEB, which is where we like to shop in Houston, had some really wonderful store brand things that kind of, you know, we tried at a time when maybe our first choice wasn't available, and then were pleasantly surprised. And I tried something similar here with, we shop at a store called Food City, and they have a store brand for a whole lot of things. And they have a Goldfish cracker alternative that are penguins. They're actually better than Goldfish.
Ah, there you go.
to my taste, they're cheesier and crunchier. They're very crispy. And Goldfish have sort of a subtle cheese taste, which they're now compensating for by having bags that are branded Flavor Blasted, you know. And it's like, if you realize people want more flavor, why don't you just make them with more flavor? But I digress.
You do. Clearly you have an opinion on the crackers.
M says, on the subject of space, empty space is where the cats can romp.
Exactly. Well, and you know, if you're somebody that has pets, you may be comfortable with all of the piled up block things, but maybe you can adjust it to make it easier for your cats to play and have more room and space. They adjust to what you provide for them, but they will be much happier if it's not super crowded too.
Yeah. Dogs will also adjust to whatever circumstances you put them in, but they won't be happy about it. They're kind of creatures of habit. And so every time you change things, dogs are like, what? I don't get it. Two different people chimed in almost simultaneously saying that we need t-shirts that say, filling your space will not fill your heart.
Oh, there we go.
Eclair and Leela both jumped on that. Leela also said, stitch that on a pillow, make a poster.
Right? Exactly. Make that your, affirmation on the wall in the mirror in the bathroom. Yeah, it's a good one. And it is, there are people that are living with a level of trauma. They're trying to recover from a level of trauma that changing the physical environment feels like they're protecting their life that way, that it feels the only way they can be calm. And for people in that position, I don't want to just diminish your need for that to be true in the moment. I would just encourage that it's something that you continue to explore with a professional so that you can get beyond that point where you don't have to maintain that coping mechanism for forever, that you can move on to the next thing that is more internal and supportive instead of, because, you know, filling your space and making it difficult to move around and not being able to have people in to do repairs and not having it be physically safe for you to be moving around in the house really just threatens your life in a different way. And so you want to aim to move beyond that coping mechanism to one that's more supportive.
Gina said, sorry, I scrolled down to see if she had expanded on this. To prevent my desire to fill voids, I use an empty container to trick my brain into thinking I have no space.
So you put an empty container in there?
I'd love for Gina to expand on that. Tell us what you do specifically. I mean, I could sort of see that. Just put like some sort of, just a decorative storage.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Tammy says a placeholder.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's clever. I like it. Just so it doesn't look like a flat surface and you start putting stuff on. Exactly. Go ahead.
I was going to say, Samudra said, we can counter that perceived value thing with don't throw good money after bad. You've already spent it. You're not getting it back. But if you don't need it or love it, that's, you know, what you spent is not a reason to keep it.
Out it goes.
Go ahead, Gina.
I wanted to elaborate on that because Tammy actually in chat asked. So what I use is empty boxes, but I turn the boxes or containers in such a way where it's either bottom side is exposed to me. So that void is filled with something and I don't need to fill it because it's already filled. So when I open the door, that unsettling feeling like I don't have enough doesn't come to the forefront.
Oh, that's really, it's clever. That's very clever because you're sort of like tricking your mind a little bit into believing that it's full, even though what it's full is a container of empty space.
Yeah.
I like it. That's good. And then you can sort of like adjust to the fact that the space is there and live with it and get used to the change, right? I'm sure that's part of it, is that you're just adjusting to how you've shifted it around and made it be different.
And it's gone from my closet to my drawers to I'm hoping to put it into the pantry.
Yeah. That's a great idea. I really like it. And it is it's a conscious trick. Like, you know that the container is empty, but it still allows you to go, okay, that space is off limits. I don't get to put anything else in there. And it sort of gives you a temporary, it's like I think of it as a stop bead. We use stop beads at the end of a thread to basically sort of make a knot so that beads can't run off the end of the thread, particularly when we're starting a project. And this is sort of your stop bead of organizing. You're putting the container in there so that you don't put anything else. I really like it. Thanks for sharing. That's awesome.
Ginger shared, for the past few years, I've planned purchases, clothes, housewares, electronics, repairs, et cetera. I have an actual list. There may be a few impulse buys, but I list those too, and whether it was a good buy or a regret, and whether or not I returned it.
That's some real serious analysis of your shopping behavior. That's great. And I love that you've shifted to planning stuff that you buy, but then you're also noticing when you go off plan and how that works for you and whether it was worth it or not. And that's always useful feedback. Every time you go off plan and then it turns out that it was a mistake, you're like, yeah, shouldn't go off plan. Or maybe I went off plan and it solved another problem that I wasn't prepared for, I hadn't anticipated yet, or it's good. It's good feedback to have.
Emily Sue says, my emotionally charged word is clunky. I have things that I will never get rid of, but that contradict the way I want to live. I want the item, but I also want to be able to move on a whim or travel. So I will have to find storage solutions for my clunky items.
The clunky items being like when you move out of your apartment and then travel, or yes, she says yes. Okay. Interesting. The clunky items definitely. So I'm guessing that is, you know, furniture, large decorative objects, things like that, that aren't going to be things that you pack to run with. Grandfather clock. Yes.
Yeah. Very, very fragile things.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, there you go. I guess if your life is going to be in motion and transition, you want to be able to move around quickly, then having a storage unit becomes your sort of permanent expense, parking space, residence while you're in motion.
Linda said, instead of boundaries or rules, using the word guideline is very helpful to me. For example, I do not have rules or boundaries about keepsakes, but I do have a practical guideline which has helped me save a small collection of special objects.
That's good. And guidelines are flexible by definition, right? And so that gives you some wiggle room if you have a really strong emotional response to something.
Yeah. It's another great example of just how words have power, and which words we choose may reveal something about the underlying thinking. Like the word diet is so super loaded, you know, it means to most people deprivation and starving yourself and cutting out all the things suffering. You really enjoy and suffering. And And so, you know, when you're, if you're trying to lose weight, you need to really not think in terms of diet, but think in terms of what would be good for me? What are some things that are good for me that I can eat more of and enjoy?
Mm-hmm.
I struggle exactly. with that, needless to say.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So Muji reminded us, algorithms. We use, we've talked about that in shows before, the concept of having algorithms, which is basically, you know, stating out loud parameters that you use to filter contents. And so an algorithm about clothing might be, if I haven't worn it in 6 months, I need to look at it and decide if it still needs to stay. If it's got a stain on it that I can't easily fix, if it has a tear in it that I can't easily repair, if I don't have the time to make repairs and I don't have time to fix stains, then the fact that it has a stain means I'm not going to wear it. I'm never going to get time to fix it. And that means it's time for it to go and let somebody else have the problem.
Okay. One more comment, and then we need to get to some announcements, and then okay. I'll come back to you for a final thought and the tittle and so forth. Connie said, one of the loaded words for me is later, as in do it later, buy it later, need it later.
Think about it later.
Yeah.
Yeah. I encounter that one all the time with my clients. I put something in front of them and ask them to start working on it. And I get a lot of, I'll deal with that later. I can't deal with that now. Like, okay, but you're paying me to help you deal with it now. That's the point of our exercise here today. So sometimes I can push people and sometimes I can't. Sometimes it's really like that. What they're really saying to me is, the emotion attached to this pile is so challenging that I cannot face it in this moment. So usually what I try to do is find out what the real, what's making them say later, and see if it's something that is strategic or like project planning. Is it later because you can't contemplate how to solve the problem? Or is it later because thinking about it makes you want to sob? And so if it's more emotion laden, then maybe we can come back to it in smaller pieces. And I would often postpone in that moment so that we can talk about it separately from the stuff. But if it's, I don't know what to do with it, it's like, okay, then let's stop and figure it out. Like, if what's hanging you up, if you're saying I'll deal with this later, really means I don't know what to do about this, then we need to stop and figure it out. And so later is a good postponement that means you will just touch things over and over again. And I used to do it. It's one of my short speaking topics used to be, if you deal with it later, all you're really saying is, I'm having so much fun suffering around facing this item that I want to come back and suffer some more again at another time. And so skip that, deal with it now, get it over with. It probably, most often, it won't be as bad as you think.
Okay. I said that was the last comment, but there's one more that's just too important to skip. Okay. And that Deborah said, I never have enough Post-its. I keep running out. So we will post Deborah's address in the show notes so everyone can send Deborah all of their overstock of Post-its.
Oh my God.
Okay.
We can make that happen.
We won't really. We won't. We wouldn't do that to Deborah. We like Deborah. Besides, I want to stay at Deborah's place when we visit Vienna. And
right?
If the Post-its are all there, there won't be room. Okay, let's talk about next week.
Okay.
Some of us approach organizing projects with our heads stuffed full of myths, legends, and bald-faced lies that we've heard. The products of popular TV shows, mass market books, nagging parents, and other people's confusion. In our next episode, we'll uncover the realities hiding behind some of these popular misconceptions about decluttering your stuff. Join us next week, April 19th, 2022, at the usual time for Decluttering with Bigfoot, Organizing Myths versus Reality. Okay, what is your final thought on words of power?
All right, this is my final thought today. We aren't asking or telling you to change a single thing about yourselves. That is 100% true. We think you're all beautiful and whole exactly as you are. We're only encouraging you to seek a deeper clarity about your thoughts, your feelings, your habits, and your motivations as they're expressed in the language that you use to talk about your stuff. If that's something that might help you have, do, or be more of what you want out of life, that is our wish for you.
Let's talk tittle.
Okay. This week's tittle, recite, reflect, and reframe. Recite, reflect, and reframe. This week's assignment is to spend some time thinking about the language we use to talk about our lives and our stuff with the goal of talking in a clearer, more thoughtful, and more self-supportive way. So recite, what negative things do you casually or habitually say about or even to your stuff? Write down or record audio or video of a few words, phrases, or statements that you've heard yourself using. The reflect step is to contemplate or meditate on what these expressions reveal about your thoughts, feelings, and beliefs about your home and belongings. Are they honest? Are they exaggerated? Are they self-deprecating? Do they echo a negative opinion that someone else has expressed? Then the last step is to reframe it. For each negative word or phrase on your list, write or dictate an affirmation or a positive sentiment as a counterpoint. For example, if you wrote, my house is always a mess, you might counter with, my house is a lively expression of my active and interesting life. And we can't wait to see what you do with it.
Okay, we have just a little time to spare, so I want to read a comment from Anya and see what you can say to this.
Okay.
I struggle with giving up some of my dancing stuff, how to do some routines and so on. It was and is part of my identity and of my happiness and pure joy. There hasn't been anything more joyful in my life, but I can do no more than 3 minutes of dancing now and probably in the future. What to do? I am at a loss.
So this is one of those things where we have outgrown the activity, but not the love of it, right? So you still find dancing fabulous and you still wish that you could do it. But the reality is that your ability to function in that activity has changed. So then the activity has actually sort of become a keepsake for you instead of it's not part of your active life, it's part of your memory life. And having those keepsakes around dance sounds like it simultaneously is something that you love, and it also makes you sad about the loss of the ability to do it. This is where I think anything dance would be a keepsake that would in theory make you happy, but the volume becomes a challenge. And so you want to concentrate on keeping the things that are the best representation to you. So are all the, do you have a whole bunch of reference material about doing the specific steps? And maybe you can pick the 10%, 5%, 2% of those that are really the best examples and let the volume go. So you end up keeping a sample of all the things that you associate with your dancing life, but you keep a more concentrated layer of it instead. Does that make sense? You probably have a million tap shoes or million shoes that you would wear in that situation, but you can keep one or two of the shoes to show you your shoe collection as a keepsake and let the rest go on and be somebody else's. And this is also an environment where you shift from doing the dancing to watching the dancing, to supporting other dancers, to you become the wise woman who is the teacher and not the student. And so you're in this position now where you can't do, but you can still critique, advise, support. You can still give people gear, ideas, thoughts for people that are actively doing it as opposed to not being able to do it. And that's where you're standing. And so you become, I think of it as the wise crone woman in the corner who is being the head of the dance community and sending your wisdom from your life out into the world. Anya has her hand up, so please chime in.
Go ahead, Anya.
So it's, yes, being the wise woman, but I also can't go anywhere to counsel people with dancing. So it's kind of really just my thing. And it's more the documentation of everything I have learned that I can't let go.
Oh.
And the DVDs and CDs, and it's not shoes, it's not clothes. It's just
so it's training and instruction, and
yes, it's training and to remember what I have learned, to refresh it sometime, and I guess I won't be able to. And yeah, it's just I can't let that go.
Oh, well, you might consider if you can access some people who a Facebook group, a local dance troupe, there's companies and schools and all that kind of stuff. Maybe it would make you feel better if you knew that it went on to support other dancers. Like you learned it and you can't execute it anymore, but someone else can use the DVDs and you can have pictures or a list or photographs of you doing these specific things and yeah. Not actually keep the library DVDs that somebody else could use to learn from.
Yeah, I think nobody else can use it because I recorded the lessons I took and the special routines that I was taught.
And right?
It's not anything that I bought. It's just...
Oh, right. Okay, so it's home videos.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, so maybe you would rather have that in a digitized form so that you can play it on the computer and watch yourself dancing.
Yes, I don't know.
I don't know. Okay.
I'm so sorry.
That's okay. That's all right. But I hear the struggle here. And yes. I've heard that conversation, not just about anything where somebody is trying to, somebody says, YouTube is full of home videos. You could post those videos online for people to watch as examples if they wanted to. And yes, it sounds like you're grieving the loss of the ability to do the dancing. And I totally understand that. We hear that a lot. That's what's, you get to a point where you can't do it anymore and it's sad.
Yes. And it's the only thing I was really, really, really good at.
Oh, right.
So, yeah.
So maybe the trick is to figure out a way for you to have dance in your life, even though you can't actually do it yourself.
Yes.
Maybe it's, watching recordings, participating in shows. You can go and see things, but there's also, there's all kinds of recorded of dancing things. Maybe you just need to be watching and experiencing someone else dancing, even though it's not you. Yes. Sometimes you just have to be the spectator instead of the active participant, but you can still enjoy dancing as a spectator and watching people do it.
Yeah.
And we feel hard. The loss.
Yes. So thank you anyway.
You're welcome.
Complicated. Thank you.
I think you should, put your videos up on YouTube and let other people look at them too.
Okay. I will think about that.
Right.
Thanks, Anya.
There's people on there's videos on YouTube of people running into walls. Why shouldn't there be videos of you playing dancing, doing dancing exercises?
Okay. We are just about out of time. Tammy asked, I wonder if we could post our affirmation somewhere to see everyone's. And yes, I'm going to show you again the where the show notes for this episode will be. That is at CFHOU.com/TCFW115. That will be up tomorrow. I usually have the show notes posted by about 24 hours after the show itself. So those are posts on our website that have comments enabled. And so we'd be delighted if you shared your responses to the tittle there. And that's true every week.
Out.
Yeah. If you're watching this on YouTube, we'd love for you to join us live. To get notifications about upcoming events, we invite you to join the meetup group by visiting cfhou.com/meetup. You can also follow us on Facebook by going to cfhou.com/Facebook, or join our mailing list by visiting cfhou.com/subscribe. We'd love to hear from you, so please send us your questions, comments, and topic suggestions on YouTube, Facebook, or anywhere else that you find us. You can always reach us through our website at clutterfairhouston.com.
Thanks, everybody, for coming. Anya, I hope you see that a bunch of people are saying that they want to see you dancing. So now you have an audience. You need to go put them out to satisfy your audience of all your dancing videos. And we will wait patiently to see them out there. And we will see you guys next week. Thanks so much for coming.
Bye-bye.